The Ten Commandments, we looked at those last week, and we're going to just talk about a couple things. And what that little cartoon says is it's God giving the Ten Commandments to Moses the second time and saying, see if you can keep them out of the government's hands this time. Separation of church and state's a beautiful thing, and yet our government has interpreted it all in the wrong way, and they want us to be separate and not be able to speak anything. But they want to have control and mandate what we as the church do. As I have been finding out lately as I'm legalizing our church here and involved in all that process. But the Ten Commandments were given, as we suggested last week, to a covenant community. The law, the Ten Commandments were never given to redeem Israel, and a lot of people misunderstand that. They were already redeemed before they got to Sinai, weren't they? Chapter 14, when they saw the mighty Egyptian army dead washing up on the seashore, their hearts were filled with fear of what God had done and the recognition of what he had done. It says that they believed. Not every single individual, but the larger group of them believed. It's like many churches today have folks that have believed and folks who haven't believed. So it's not a blanket statement that they all believe, but a large proportion of them believe. As we come into the law, talking about the commandments, we looked at these last week. Last week we saw that God gave his people 10 commandments, not 10 suggestions. Today people say, well, what do we got to do what God says for? Who's he anyway? Our society is just going down the tubes. And we see the results of it all around us, don't we? And I don't know about you, but just in the past couple weeks, I've just seen an acceleration of problems around the world with China and the slap in the face that we got yesterday from the chairman of China going to Starbucks and Bill Gates rather than to the White House. Never been done before in history. And that's just a commentary that you don't tell me what to do. I'll tell you what we'll do for you. Everything we pick up today's got made in China on it just about, doesn't it? And so we see a shift. We've got China causing us problems. We've got Iraq. We've got Iran, Afghanistan. Afghanistan, they're back to running all their opium, and we've paid for it all. Aren't you happy? Aren't you proud of yourselves, Americans? The world is in a meltdown, and it's going to get so much worse, according to biblical revelation, because men refuse to bow in submission to God and his own people. He called Israel out of Abraham is the father of Israel, and he called him out of all the peoples of the earth to make a unique and special people of him, a people who he could dwell with, who he could abide with, who he could love, and they could love him. And then the whole world, all the nations would hear about him as the Jews shared him. They failed in their commission, so now he's given it to you and I to do. How are we doing? Are we living with him in love and obeying him and sharing him with others? A lot of similarities, aren't there, as we've looked at this. So 10 commandments, not 10 suggestions. We also noted that the 10 commandments use verbs, not nouns. Nouns leave room for debate, but verbs do not. You shall not worship false gods. You shall not make for yourself an idol. So all of these are in the verbal form. And you just aren't to do it, period. I thought this was interesting as I looked this over. At the beginning of this section that we're going to look at tonight and that we looked at last week, we had 20, in chapter 20, 23, we have prohibition of idolatry, and then that's followed by proper forms of worship, how to properly worship our God and serve him. And then we're going to have what we're going to look at tonight, and I don't think we'll get through it all tonight, but there's 42 judgment sections on how to properly prohibitions and proper treatments. 42 judgments, and then we're going to come at the end of this section in chapter 23, and notice again the prohibition. You see the top here? The prohibition against idolatry and proper forms of worship. So this is called a pericope in Hebrew literature, where what's most important is at the center, but it's bookended, it's bracketed, it introduces the truth of no idols, I'm the Lord your God, worship and serve me only, and here's how you do that. And then he's going to give them 42 commands to judgments and how to properly behave towards one another. And then at the end of all of that instruction, guess what he's going to say again? I am the Lord your God. No idols. Worship me only because I'm the only God. And here's how you worship me. So he starts with that and he ends with that. And I thought that was very interesting how this was put together. The Israelites were to not make any idols representing gods other than Yahweh, nor were they to represent Yahweh by making idols to help them worship him. No idols. There's a lot of religions throughout history that have idols as part of their worship, and we are commanded not to do that. And some people even take this so far as not to have any pictures of Jesus in the house. I like pictures of Jesus, but I don't worship that picture of Jesus. That's the difference. Idol worship has always been having a form that you bow down before and worship in place of that deity or that God, supposedly. And we as Christians don't want to do that. Israel's, and then we looked in 24 to 26, right at the end there, and a couple of you were puzzled about this, so I thought we'd start there, in chapter 20, verse 24. Let me just start there. You shall make an altar of earth for me, and you shall sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen. In every place where I cause my name to be remembered, I will come to you and bless you. And if you make an altar of stone for me, you shall not build it out of cut stones. For if you wield your tool upon it, you will profane it. And you shall not go up by your steps to my altar, that your nakedness may not be exposed. That's the most important part of this whole thing, is that if you build an altar, you just build it on flat ground and you go up and serve on the altar. You don't build steps up to it to put on a big show. You don't do that. And the reason for this is the Israelites were not to have any altars with steps as many of the Canaanites did throughout the land. They did this in order to make the nakedness of the flesh of their priests appear before the people as they went up these steps to give their offerings. In fact, in a lot of these ancient religions, the peoples of the ancient Near East, the Sumerians, the Canaanites, for instance, their priests used to perform ritual ceremonies in a state of nakedness. They'd get off all their clothes because they taught that it was defiling and you need to be naked before God the way that you were created. And you know where all that led. So God, to protect against that, said that you are to stay covered. Some of the priests would wear a little short apron and expose themselves. And God, from the beginning, is going to have specific rituals where they're to wear long robes, they're to be covered, and not have steps so that no flesh would be exposed. This simple description of true worship is intended to portray the essence of the Mount Sinai covenant in terms that are identical to those of the patriarchs. You think of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. They just built simple little altars and offered up sacrifices to the Lord, didn't they? Especially Abraham is the greatest example. He built altars all over the place all the time and offered offerings to God. The others, it seems like Isaac, we don't have as much information about him. And Jacob, it just kind of happened to him. You remember at Jacob's ladder? Seems like the first time that God revealed himself to him. And he built an altar there and called the place Bethel, didn't he? The house of God. He built a simple rock altar and offered up a sacrifice to God. And you remember he made that covenant with God. If you'll take me out, bring me back, keep me safe, prosper me, do this, gimme, 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 gimme. Then when I come back here, I'm going to give you 10% and I'll let you be my God. What a deal, huh? God's got to be sitting in heaven just saying, man, am I going to have to work on this guy? And he did work on him. He worked on him real well, didn't he, with Uncle Laban. But just a little bit of background here that worship of God is to be something very simple. We make it so difficult. I love brand new believers. When you lead a new believer to Christ and you ask them, Bob or Bill or Mary, would you like to pray? And, you know, I love to hear new believers when they pray, God, this is Bob, you know, just in simplicity. Thank you for my salvation and thank you for my new Christian friends. Thank you for deliverance from my horrible life of sin and setting me free. Do you pray like that? Just simple prayers of adoration and worship. And God just sits back and says, that's my boy. That's my girl. You know, he loves to have us approach him in that way. That's how simple he wants our worship to be. But he also doesn't want us to be profane. He doesn't want us to be worshiping him 1 minute and then getting right back into the flesh and going back to our old sinful ways the next. That isn't a picture of true Christianity, is it? Because we have been set free. The bonds have dropped off. He has set us free. So now we start into this section in 21:1. We start into this section of 42 judgments throughout this this long section here, 21 to 23. 42 of these laws, different laws, judgments of God. The first one is laws concerning slaves. All the nations from the beginning of time have had slaves. Is that shocking news to anybody? There's still most nations in the world have slaves today, don't they? Many of them are called indentured servants. These peoples here, the Arab peoples, the Hebrews in the land, they all have servants. Their whole culture is driven by servants because they won't touch anything. And so they hire servants to do everything for them. That's as old as time. But something that's going to be very different here with God's covenant people is, I'm going to permit you to have servants too, because you're going to have them. Everybody has them. But I'm going to regulate the way that you treat them. You will treat them with respect, with dignity. And he's going to lay down certain laws here as to servants. Concerning slaves, 21:1-11. Now these are the ordinances which you are to set before them. So God's telling Moses, now I'm going to instruct you. You write this down and you go tell the people and you teach them and instruct them. If you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve you for 6 years, but on the seventh year, he shall go out as a free man without any payment. If he comes to you alone, he shall go out alone. If he is the husband of a wife, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall belong to her master, and he shall go out alone. Some of these instructions, they just strike us as funny, don't they? I don't know about you, but they strike me as funny. If I working for you and you got a good looking gal there and I marry up with her, and then after my 7 years, I'm on the seventh year, I'm free to go out. Well, I want to take Mama and little baby Bubba and Sissy with me. And God says no, because they aren't your property. You were able to enjoy them as you lived in peace under the rule of your master, but they're not your property. You're a slave. You have earned your freedom being a Hebrew. You sold yourself into indentured servanthood because you ran up a bill, you couldn't pay it. Just think of the credit card companies today. Man, we'd all have several dozen slaves, wouldn't we, if if people couldn't just get out of their debt and get rid of their credit card. Forget you, I'm not paying you. Well, in this society, they didn't get away with that. And they would sell themselves into indentured servanthood. And so after the seventh year, he's able to go out. But he doesn't want to leave his wife and children. So verse 5, if the slave says, I love my master, I love my wife and my children, I will not go out a free man. Then his master shall bring him to God, and then he shall bring him to the door of the doorpost. So he brings him before God and has him tell God this. Okay, tell God what you just told me. So this is a big ceremony. This is very binding. This is a covenant, if you will, where this man comes before probably the priests and before God and says, I don't want to go out a free man. I want to stay here and serve for the rest of my life my master. My master's good to me. I want to serve him, and I want my wife and my kids. And the master would say, okay, you've told it to God. You've told it to everybody. Then he brings him to the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and then he shall serve him permanently. An awl is just like an ice pick. It's a sharp instrument, a nail or an ice pick, and he back him up against a doorpost and whip the old earlobe out there and you pierce it. And from that day on, then that man is your property. And I don't see here anywhere where it says put a pierced earring in that piercing. But that's a subject for another day. He shall serve him permanently. And if a man sells his daughter, now that's what to do with a Hebrew man, and if he gets a family and so forth. These are regulations to protect family relationships and to protect the slave. And things were a whole lot better for a Hebrew slave than a native foreigner. But God's even going to lay down commands to protect foreigners who become slaves as well. Now, if a man sells his daughter as a female slave, She's not to go free as the male slaves do. This is a question Georgia answered me earlier. At 7 years, can she go free? Nope. It says right here that she can't go free. Verse 7. And if she is displeasing in the eyes of her master. So now this is a father that sells his little daughter to some man to become his wife. And if the man, if she's displeasing in the eyes of her master who designated her for himself, he purchased her for himself, then he shall set her, let her be redeemed. He does not have authority to sell her to a foreign people because of his unfairness to her. So a man marries a young woman, and for whatever reason he doesn't like her. She burns the biscuits, or she's just not what he thought he was getting. Then he can put her up and make a proclamation that whoever in her family wants to redeem her can come and redeem her. Does Ruth and Boaz ring any bells? The near relative, at first he said, I'll redeem her. And then Boaz put the twist in the barb in there, didn't he? I'll redeem her and her property. And then Boaz says, well, in the day you redeem her, Naomi, and her property, you got to redeem that little pagan, that little Moabite girl. You know, the little one that came in here barefooted and burnt dark. And you know that little Moabite girl? You have to redeem her. I'm sure he said it two or three times in different ways. And then the man started thinking. He said, wait a minute. I've got my own kids, and I have to go home and deal with my wife. Forget it. You redeem her. I don't want her. You redeem her. And Boaz says, okay, guys, you all heard him. And so Boaz redeemed her. So that's what is the law that's being stated here, that she's not to be mistreated. And I don't know in your mind, but in my mind, her dad's selling her. She's been mistreated already. But families in this culture, they couldn't go down to Bank of America and take out a loan. They didn't have loans. You want money? I want property. You don't have any property worth taking? I'll take your son or I'll take your daughter. This is a whole different culture, isn't it? It's a different mindset, and it still goes on today. Lisa?
Well, I was just thinking, you know, what reason would there be? And I can see the protection in this. I mean, what an awful thing to be sold as a slave. But if you were turned out after a number of years as a woman, not redeemed back by your family, what That's right. men in that culture would want you, it would just have, you would have
All of these laws have these exact, I can't go into all of them in detail. If you see something or you think of something, throw it out here, because we'd be here too long picking these all apart. But the major provision here is Almighty God wanting a holy, pure people. And remember we said the first four commandments are relationships between God and his people, right? The other six, where's the major problems? Well, if we don't get the first four right, the other, we need six, more than six, but he's hit six major ones to deal with our relationships with one another. If we're going to be a covenant community and we're all going to get along and love, well, we need some rules, don't we? Because none of us like rules, and we all want to bend the rules to suit ourselves, don't we? But God is very specific here, and these laws, as we read them, they may sound strange to us, but this is life. This is real life in an agrarian society and culture. This was life in Israel, and God's laying down these mandates to protect his people. So is what's happening good? No, but it's real life. And in light of what is going to happen in real life, God is protecting them. He's making provision to protect them. Sanctity of life. Does it ring any bells? We don't have much sanctity of life anymore, do we? Big dog rules. It's what I want. I don't care about you. I've got the money. I'll do as I please. I'll hire the best attorney. I don't care what you say. That's our mindset in our world today, and it's really been the mindset throughout time. Nothing new. We're just perfecting it, aren't we, in our society today. So with that in mind, as Lisa brought up, in my way of thinking, the dad having to sell his daughter, what a horrible thing, but they're forced to have to do that to survive. And this still goes on today. It baffles me. When I went to Israel, we heard stories like this and met people and saw this type of thing. And yeah, the son would
but
go
the
free.
Daughter has to stay in this commitment.
Well, the daughter is, this man wants her as his wife is the idea. Or, as we're going to see here in a minute, he arranges a marital contract and he wants this young girl for his son. So he actually purchases her. But she won't go free. And as long as she's married to one of them, everything's hunky-dory. But if they try to send her out, they just can't kick her out, as Lisa brought up. They have to get somebody else in the family to redeem her back. And that would be a good deal because you could redeem her back for whatever. I'll give you $5. Well, I paid $500. Well, that's your problem. I'll give you $5. The law says you can't turn her out. Here's $5. So they all took advantage of that. They all found ways around the laws and took advantage of one another throughout their history. But we don't do that, do we? No. And when we get to one of these days, if Jesus should delay his coming again, we'll get to Deuteronomy 24, and that's where the rules of divorce are set in stone. And God had to add that to because they were abusing it because of this right here. They were married to one woman, and then years might pass, and then some young gal comes to town for the festival or whatever, and they see her. Well, they'd throw their wife out. I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you for burning my biscuits. They'd throw her out, grab this new gal, and marry her. And so God, through Moses, said, no, you will not do that. And the language is very specific there. It says, if a man, it's similar to this, God says, if a man take a wife and he finds some displeasing thing in her, usually some type of showing that she had been sexually unfaithful or fornicated before marriage, if you will, then he is allowed to put her away, but he specifically has to write up the bill of divorcement, state what it is that he found wrong in her, call the elders of the city to the city gate, and have a public hearing. Hello. And that charge better be true, right? So it really restricted the practice of divorce that was getting out of hand under Moses. But it was supposed to be monogamous from the beginning. And here, this is way before the times of the kings and the abuses that are going to come later. That'll be part of just becoming a king and having all that power and money and doing as they please. But from the beginning, God wanted one man and one woman, and he's trying to establish these laws to protect that and to support that idea. But as I say, they're going to ignore it and get around it later anyway and not care what he has to say. Verse 9, and if he designates her for his son, so he didn't buy her for himself, but he bought her for his son, this young woman, and he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. He purchases her, but she's no longer merely a slave. She is now a daughter-in-law. She becomes his daughter, and he is to respect her and deal with her in the custom of a daughter. Verse 10, if he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food. So this, Sean, I think goes to what you're saying here. If he should take to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food or clothing or her conjugal rights. So here's problem in, you know, here's some problem right here coming up. But again, God's in heaven. We're down here doing our own thing. Do we listen to him on a good day? Usually not. And he's trying to set up, do you see the protection built into this? Taking this young woman, mistreating her, he sees another younger woman, prettier, better, whatever. He takes her, and then what's he going to do with the one he had? Well, he can't get rid of her, but he can sure mistreat her, can he? Cut back on her food allowance, take away her Dillard's charge card, and mistreat her. God says, no, you shall not do that. And I love this part here, and this really only applies to younger women. Take away her conjugal rights. She wants to come spend time with hubby. He's got to give her some time. And the new wife, I mean, just look at the problems already. Just as we read these verses, the protections that God's building in. And I hope you see that that's what it is.
You could marry, I guess, in that society, as many women as you could afford to keep. Right?
And it wasn't supposed to be that way in Israel, but it's the way all the nations were. And so in reality, that's God's dealing with that type of mindset. They're way past monogamy. They're not being monogamous, and we only have what's written here, and it would seem to imply that they're not being monogamous. If a man should take another woman, which it just considered that there some of them are going to do that if they can afford to do that, well then they can't mistreat the one they had. She's still in the family too, and then here are the problems start. And we've already seen that back in Genesis. Look at Jacob. We've already seen this type of thing. Look at Abraham, even with Hagar, and all the problems that have been created. So these are protections. The men are going to continue to do as they please to do. Is it against the law? Yeah, it's against the law. But the way that they dealt with it is that they would, it's a slave girl in their way of thinking. She's a slave girl. I purchased her. I'm not happy with her now. So I'm getting me a new one. Okay, fine. but you cannot mistreat her. That's the point. So God's trying to build protections in because he knows sinful men are going to continue to be sinful. And under the law, it wouldn't specifically be adultery where you're going and getting in a relationship as a married man with another man's wife type of thing. That's more specific. And all of these were practices prevalent in the Middle East, and they just adopted them. Were they supposed to as God's men? No, they weren't supposed to. But if you're the king, you're the big dog, you got all the money. These are pretty girls I'm seeing over at this guy's palace and this guy's palace. And why not? Who's to say it's wrong? God says it's wrong. You're not to accumulate wives or money or horses. God's dealing with sinful people that these problems are going to be around no matter what he says. He has laws that he's going to put in place to protect those who are abused and try to keep them from being overly abused. But he's not going to stop sinful men from sinning. Like I said before, if we were to try to implement some of these things in our day and age, my professor said 30 years ago out in California, La Mirada, he said if we started stoning all the adulterers around here, we wouldn't be able to get around on the freeways. There'd be rock piles everywhere. And as you study Israel's history, they didn't follow through with these instructions as well. They didn't stone people for adultery. They were all doing it. They just became, first they were living among the Canaanites. Then they were living with the Canaanites, and pretty soon they were acting just like the Canaanites. They became just like them. You couldn't tell them apart. Sound familiar to us? The church today. And it breaks God's heart. And all we can do as a new covenant church in Jesus Christ is to preach the power and keep reminding each other we're free. Quit it. Quit it. Quit it. What's that look like? Well, here's what the books say it looks like. So we have the power, and we all know we're free through Jesus Christ. So let's show our world that this really does work. And all through here, we have examples of godly men and women here and there, little snapshots of those who lived it, didn't they? So it's not impossible to do. It just takes the freedom in Jesus Christ for you and I. I think I often say this. You and I are living in the best day, the best of times, because we've got the Spirit of God living in us. Paul tells us in Romans chapter 6, do you not know, brethren, that the same power that raised Jesus to life from resurrected him now resides within you? That same power. So stop sinning. Stop it. You're presenting your flesh to sin. That's past. That's behind you. The power of Christ that's resurrected him has caused you to be born again. Start living like it. And I don't know how we got off on that. Okay, sounds good. Well, that's what we want to be around here. That's what we want to be about, is go tell people this really works. Because I can tell you, he has set me free. Here's what I used to do, and here I am today. I'm just a good old Jesus freak. You know? I love to hear that. I love it when I get reports back that different ones are calling their kids little Jesus freaks. Blesses my heart. Some laws concerning slaves. Let's get on down here. So, verse 10, if he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her three things, her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. And if he will not do these three things for her, then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. So what do you think they would do? You think they want him, is the new wife, the new younger, more beautiful, pretty little wife, does she want the old wife around the house? She don't want her around there anymore. So forget her food and we got a way around this right here. Don't give her any more food. Take away her Dillard's card, and you aren't sleeping with her anymore. So she's out of here. Just pack her bag and send her back to Pop's house. That's what they ended up doing with these things. But do you see the protection built in? Because if the protection wasn't there, then they'd keep them there and just abuse them. And God's trying to protect against that. He wants them to be a holy people, not to be living in sin like all the other peoples of the earth. He wants them to respect and love one another. Laws concerning personal injury. Homicide, 12 through 17. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint you a place to which you may flee. In the case of unpremeditated murder, the murderer could flee to what's going to be called the city of refuge. God's going to put three of those on the east and three of those in the land. So that they can flee to the cities of refuge. They'll be scattered all around the land where they can get to them. If they kill somebody, non-premeditated, But if it's premeditated, then there, as we're going to see in the rest of these verses, there's no escape for them. Verse 14, if, however, a man acts presumptuously toward his neighbor so as to kill him craftily, so premeditation, he plans this. He plans it out. He's mad at his neighbor for whatever, and he's going to get even with him by killing him. That's premeditated murder. You are to take him even from my altar that he may die. And a good example of this was that I thought about, and there's a number of examples of this, but thinking of King David when he was dying, he told Solomon, this guy did me wrong, this guy did me wrong, and this guy did me wrong. And as soon as I depart to go be with the good Lord, son, I want you to take care of these guys, okay? Okay, Pop. And so here's one of them right here. Solomon dismissed, this is 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 27. Solomon dismissed Abiathar from being priest to the Lord in order to fulfill the word of the Lord, which he'd spoken concerning the house of Eli and Shiloh. None of his descendants shall be priest anymore in Israel. That eventually came to pass. Now the news came to Joab, who was David's commander of his army. This Joab was a bad boy. I mean, this guy was tough. And anything that needed done, he did it. And yet he reached a point in his life where he murdered a couple people against King David's word. One of them I think of is Saul's general Abner, made a covenant with David. And Abner had killed Joab's brother, and so Joab was just waiting for the day when he could get his hands on him and kill him. And Abner, he was tough too. These generals, these guys were tough fighting machines. But Joab now, he had violated David's oath, so David said, take care of him, son. So news came to Joab, verse 20, 28, that Joab had followed Adonijah, although he had not followed Absalom, and Joab fled to the tent of the Lord and took hold of the horns of the altar. So Joab knows his coming. He's coming. He's next. He's going to get it. He's going to be killed. And so he runs into the tent of the Lord, and in the altar, on each corner, there were horns on each corner of the altar. So he runs in there and grabs a hold of one of those horns and says, I've sought sanctuary with the Lord. You can't get me now. Can't get me. So it was told to King Solomon. Joab's fled to the tent of the Lord, and he's beside the altar. So Solomon called for Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, saying to him, go fall upon him. Now, these are the kind of priests I like to hang around with. This guy is really bad. I mean, Joab is so tough. He is so bad. Solomon calls Benaiah, one of his priests and one of his generals. This guy's a real fighting machine, a younger man. And he says, go in there and just stick him. Go kill him right there. I don't care if he has a hold of the altar or not. And so it was told King Solomon he'd fled there. So Benaiah came to the tent of the Lord, and he said to him, thus the king has said to me, come out here. But he said, no, I will not die. I will not come out. I'll die here. And Benaiah went back. He told the king. He says, he won't come out, O king. Says he's going to die there. Solomon says, great, let him die there. Go back and stick him. And so the king said to him, do as he's spoken. Go and fall upon him, and then drag him out of there and bury him, that you may remove from me and my father's house the blood which Joab shed without cause. So Benaiah went back in there and stuck him, killed him, drug him out of there and buried him. These were some tough guys. I love reading these stories. They just thrill my soul. So that's what happens. But in a case where you didn't premeditate manslaughter, somebody jumps out in front of your car, boom, you hit them, they're deader than a doornail. Well, if they were from Arkansas, and this was a few years ago, they could make their way up here, and they still have family feuds down there. I'm not kidding. And they would come and hunt you down, and they could make it right. So instead of that, you can flee to the city of refuge, and you're safe there. And you have to live there until the priest dies, and then you're free to go back out. So that's the type of thing we're talking about here. But if it's premeditated murder, you could flee to the city of refuge, but then they would have a trial, and they would call the witnesses, and they would determine if it was premeditated. If it's premeditated, they would deliver you over to the manslayer, to the relative of the one that you killed, and they'd drag you out and cut you up. That's just what they did. So that's what's being talked about here. And again, it's for protection because of the blood feud. In this day, in this culture, and still a lot of places in the world today, if you kill somebody's family member, they'll hunt you down and they'll make it right, especially, again, in the Middle East. This still is prevalent throughout the Middle East. Verse 15, if he who strikes his father is, whoever strikes his father or mother shall surely be put to death. That's a good law. He who kidnaps, I read about all these kids that go home and beat up their elderly parents and take their disability checks. We as parents are given the responsibility to train up our children according to God's word. And if we don't train them up, we're raising a generation of monsters to release on society. We need to train up our children and make them responsible so that they would never come and try to smack us around. It's a total breakdown in society, which we have today, and I would never see this from either of my lovely children or my grandchildren. But we train them with this verse to let them know, hey, you come smack pop. Oh, look at it, gets even better. Verse 16. Verse 16, he who kid, and I, you know, this is these, some of these laws, they just kill me. Like, what's the matter with our society? Why don't we do this?
Well, because we're civilized.
No, we're not. Not if we have people do kidnapping and raping women and brutalizing them. Kill them. Or even better, let's just cut off their equipment. You know, that'll put a stop to it. Cherry?
Oh.
Oh, okay. Nip it in the bud. Whoever kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or he's found in his possession, he shall surely be put to death. No matter what you may have intended, if you took somebody against their will, you shall surely be put to death. And here's verse 17, it's a little tougher than the previous verse. Whoever curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. God's serious about this, isn't he? He wants a people that are called by his name, that are an example to the rest of the nations, because the rest of the nations, they did all this every day in every way. And they didn't care because they didn't have a God who told them what they had to do and what they didn't have to do. So God's laying down the law and says, this is what I expect of you as my people. Verse 18, if men have a quarrel with one another and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die but remains in bed, if he gets up and walks around outside on a staff, then he who struck him shall go unpunished, and he shall only pay for his loss of time and shall take care of him until he's completely healed. So taking matters into your own hands with a good fist fight, you can go ahead and do that, you know, get to feeling real good about yourself. But if you knock the person up and he's got a concussion or he can't go to work, you're going to pay his maintenance until he's fully healed. And his doctor bills, that's right. Notice a stone. So these are two different classes of guys that don't like to lose. One uses a rock to be sure he's going to get him. And the other one, I'll just take it to him. You know, he's the one that works out all the time and looking for trouble. God says, go ahead. That's not the way they were to handle it. They were to bring their complaints to the elders and voice their grievances, and then the elders would deal with them. But if you want to take matters into your own hands, you go ahead. But you're going to pay his doctor bills and his monthly bills until he's going to be better. They didn't have Aflac back then. So you're going to pay if you hit him. Verse 20, if a man strikes his male or female slave with a rod and he dies at his hands, he shall be punished. If, however, he survives, if the slave survives a day or two, no vengeance shall be taken, for he is his property. Now, I don't understand that one at all. You beat them, just don't beat them past 2 days, you know, or you better doctor them up so they live 2 days, and then you don't have to worry about it. Some of these, I don't understand them, but they're in here. If you have any insights on it, let's talk about it. It's a rod, if he strikes them with a rod.
No, it says he shall be punished.
I don't know, whatever the judges determine. And we'll look at this here in just a minute. We'll get to it here, and with that, we'll have to close. Verse 22, if men struggle with each other and they strike a woman with child so that she has a miscarriage, yet there's no further injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him. So some of these, I think, are whatever the judges determine would be a fair judgment. and he shall pay as the judges decide, right there at the end of the verse. So some of these may have been set in place. I don't know. But if there is any further injury, verse 23, then you shall appoint a penalty, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. This is called the law of retaliation, the lex talion, it's referred to. And the lex talions were practiced by all ancient civilizations. And what that was, again, was a law of protection. So if you gave somebody a black eye, they couldn't come with a spear and run you through. These were laws that were put in place among all the ancient societies. And you say, well, how do you know that? Because archaeologists have dug up codes of laws from many of the ancient societies. And one of the most famous is called the Law Code of Hammurabi. And that dates to a couple hundred years, 200 to 400 years before Israel's giving of the law here. And so what is being quoted here, this life for life, eye for eye, that comes right off of one of the panels of the Code of Hammurabi. And this, again, was protection so that you couldn't get carried away and get even. In other words, you cannot mete out more justice than that which is due. And that's what all of that was saying. And it's interesting that these ancient societies, and Hammurabi was the king, one of the first kings of the Babylonian society. And he has what's called the Hammurabi lex talions, the laws of retaliation written out on law codes. So you didn't have to question what's the penalty. He had them all written out for his people, and they abided by them. And so God reaches out and takes, again, the things that are familiar with their culture and implements those. And going back to what Sean had mentioned earlier, Jesus took the lex talions in these teachings and says, you heard that it has been said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, here's a much better standard. Turn the cheek to them when they strike you. And in that context, all of the Jewish rabbis had long beards. And when they would get in an argument over any matter of law, they'd grab each other's beard and they would shake it to make a point. And Jesus said, when you go before, what Jesus is saying in the context, if we had time to flip over there to Matthew and study it, is when you go out telling people about me, go tell, right? Go tell them I'm alive and tell them they need to repent of their sin and turn to me. When you go tell them that, they aren't going to be happy. They're going to grab your beard and give it a real good shake. When they do that, turn the cheek to them. Be in submission to them. Do not fight with them in order that you might break with the way that they're used to, the regular way of argumentation. You will break down their barrier of defense when you turn the cheek to them. Then you tell them again about me. That's the way that's been explained to me by my Bible professor, Dr. Curtis Mitchell, years ago. And I found that in other commentaries, and that's about the best explanation of that I've ever heard. In the context, who's Jesus talking to? To the Jewish religious leaders who use that form of argumentation. And Jesus is talking to his disciples to say, when you go tell these people about me when I'm risen, turn the cheek. You've heard it said, and this is valid. This is a valid form of retaliation. Just don't overdo it. But I'm telling you a more excellent way. You're going to go out as my representative, so as you go out to represent me, turn the cheek. So you break with culture and you shock them. And then you'll be able to tell them about me some more. Lisa, did you have a thought on that? Amen.
Human life.
Amen.
Human life and the sanctity of life. It's not really about the punishment. It's to stop the bad behavior.
That's right. That's the first thing we said when we started into this. It's for sanctity of life, even among slaves. God says that they are created in my image, therefore you are not to mistreat them. And that's what all of these are about. And all of these are given in a culture where these abuses are common occurrence through every day. God says, you're my people in the midst of all of this. And you're not to live this way. You will in many ways look just like them, but you're going to look so much different because you're not going to treat them, misbehave and mistreat them because of the sanctity of life, because I am your God. And you are to be a holy people, so you will live this standard for me, and all the peoples around will hear about it and they'll see and they'll say, how come they're treating their slaves? How come they're living so differently? Because you're my people. You're my covenant people, and I live in your midst. And as long as you behave in this way, I'll be able to live in your midst. Well, they didn't do it, and for hundreds of years, God's graciousness, he continued to try to live with his people and straighten them out through his prophets. And finally, in the book of Ezekiel, he leaves. He says, I've had enough. And they watch his glory depart. Ezekiel records it. But that's not the end of the story, because towards the end of the book, God gives Ezekiel a vision of Jesus Christ coming again in power and glory. And he comes into his temple and he says, Jerusalem is the seat of my temple. I shall be here among my people forever, because Israel is my people, Israel and Judah, reunited in the millennial kingdom. So that's a fabulous picture. But we'll take up here. We didn't get anywhere tonight, but I sure had fun.